from Pauline. What is the relevance today for Melchizedek souls of doing the Mass and reading the Bible? Have these practices lost their power as church buildings have lost their spirit? I don't do the Mass or read the Bible. Too overwhelming and difficult to understand. But I do meditate and pray daily and enjoy sitting quietly following a small devotional reading. So what understanding, guidance and practices can the hierarchy offer us today? Practices that have relevance and power to grow the seed of Christ within. Almost answered, really.
That's a great question. And in the company of the Brotherhood of Melchizedek, we would like to answer. Firstly, there are two questions there, Pauline, or two statements. First of all, you personally do not find the Mass relevant, and you have an antagonism towards it, an inner antagonism. And you are not alone. Out of all the priests who have been ordained into the new expression, probably 60% would share that. Why is that? Well, I'll give you an answer in one word. Karma. The reason that you and others cannot come to grips with the Mass is because of karma. Now, I don't want to put any one person in the spotlight. So, in the interests of self-knowledge amongst certain individuals, I'm going to give you three examples. There was a certain cardinal in the 14th century, an outstandingly good preacher, a very powerful man, very rich, loved luxury, loved sex, but not as much as luxury, and he was a magician. He was a black magician because he used the Mass to as a magic ritual to get what he wanted. And he was successful. And that the secret of that we're not giving away at present. We don't want any more black magicians. Now, that cardinal has long since repented of his use of negative forces, and he's had to suffer a life in this incarnation, let alone other incarnations, where he's experienced a great deal of sorrow, and particularly in terms of relationships. But what this person has never been permitted to do is do the Mass. And the way that they've not been permitted to do that is because they have a fear of doing it. They cannot come to it. And it doesn't matter who tells them that it's all right, they will not do it. It doesn't matter what obligations are placed on them, they will not do it. And until that individual has confronted the karma in consciousness and forgiven themselves, they will never be able to do the Mass. Let's look at a second example. This person was a bishop in about the 6th or 5th or 6th centuries in England. And they had charge of a large church and also a convent. So this person was in charge of the diocese and the convent. And the village, if you like, because, I mean, the bishop basically ran the place. And there was a raid by, I guess, Vikings, sea raiders. And they pillaged and looted. And the bishop called everyone to the church, because he said, Christ will guard us. And he started to do Mass. He took out the elements and did the most powerful, beautiful Mass that he could. And in the midst of doing the Mass, the invaders burst in. He died because a spear was thrown through his chest just as he was about to break the bread. And the 50 or 60 people, the nuns, the villagers, the priests, all those who'd come to the church for sanctuary were slaughtered. Now, that person came into this incarnation with a great anger in the heart, might I say. Mm. And the anger is because Christ didn't come and save them. He was a very devotional bishop, a bit rigid, but he knew his theology. He knew that Christ would look after his own. But he forgot that Christ will look after his own in the afterlife, not necessarily in this life. But this person nevertheless came into incarnation, was ordained again into the order of Melchizedek. And there is this curious dichotomy in this individual today. There's an attraction and a repulsion towards things like the Mass and things that we regard as traditional in the priesthood. And so, although this person has struggled very hard to deal with it, they have to be honest in the end and say, no, that is not for me. And the reason that that is the only conclusion that they can come to is because of the spear through the heart. And until that spear is removed from the heart in consciousness, then also that person will be barred from the Mass. And the third individual that I will talk about, just so you don't think anyone is anyone in particular, this person was a priestess in ancient Egypt in the temple, and she was in the temple of Isis, where in the inner temple the bread was placed on the altar as an offering to the god. And she was only young, but she came in and she was hungry. She was just a young priestess, so she saw the bread sitting there and said, oh, that's so good. And she took a piece, just a little piece. And her sisters, the other priestesses, found her doing this, and they dragged her out and threw her into a large hole in the ground and threw stones upon her, so that she was killed by her own by the priesthood themselves. And that person today, that person has a love-hate relationship with women, by the way, loves them, needs them, and has conflicts with them, because that is still to be resolved. But because they ate of the bread on the altar, which in those days was the precursor to the Mass and the ancient mysteries, they are terrified by the Mass. They would find it hard to even have communion, and let alone pick up a liturgy book and do a communion service, a Eucharist, a Mass. They could not do that because they would be physically sick if they attempted it. And yet this person is a beautiful priest. There's no doubt about it. And all three individuals I've named are people who are wonderful priests. So the Mass is not directly connected to one's priesthood, but one's attitude to it is determined by one's karma. I want to change something here, because there is a very great misunderstanding of the Mass amongst people. And the reason is really simple. The Mass, or the Eucharist as it should properly be called, which means to give thanks. Just think of that word for a moment. It means to give thanks. But the Eucharist is part of the inner mysteries of the order of Melchizedek. Now I want to explain to you how the mysteries of the order of Melchizedek are structured. That's a good word. There's no structure in the spirit, but this will do. How they are self-organized. Now, sorry for those of you who don't like the Bible, but the Bible actually has quite a lot to say about certain things. And there is a story in the Gospel of St. John where Jesus goes out into the wilderness and 5,000 people follow him. And the disciples say to him, "Lord, we've got nothing to feed these people with." And Jesus says, "Well, you feed them. You go and do it." Now, I want to stop there because the rest of what happened, which was metaphysically beautiful, is not what I want to tell you about. How did Jesus preach? Did he stand up on a podium? Did he have a megaphone? Did he use social media? No, obviously, that one's out. How did Jesus speak? Did he have a wonderful voice? Could everyone hear him? No, he didn't. Jesus had a very soft voice. He never raised his voice, except a couple of times when he's pissed off with a Pharisee or two. I mean, Pharisees, I mean, who could blame him? Who could blame you, Lord? Pharisees, I mean, yeah, they need to be shouted at. But apart from Pharisees, Jesus would talk when he was in the spirit, which was frequent, and he would talk in a gentle voice. And around him were gathered his closest disciples. We could call them the 12. So around Christ are 12. Now, actually, there are even people closer to Christ than the 12. The 12 could all hear him. The 12 apostles, the ones that he called, please note, they were called. They didn't volunteer. They didn't say, "Excuse me, Jesus, I want to follow you. I want to be an apostle." And the couple of people who tried that, Jesus put down very smartly, "Go tell the dead to bury the dead," and so on and so forth. You can read about it in, unfortunately, the Bible. But we'll just ignore the fact that it's in the Bible. So Jesus sat there, and the 12 apostles could hear everything that he said. But there were people even closer to Jesus than the apostles. Who could possibly be closer to Jesus than the apostles? These guys who were the pinnacle of his teachings. Well, he had Mary sitting there. Often one Mary, if not two. Sometimes his mother was there. Sometimes Mary Magdalene was there. Sometimes the Mary of whom we only hear once in the Bible was there. Mary, wife of Clopas, was there. But the women were closest to Jesus. Now, why do you think at the cross the only people who were there for him were the women? Because they had received the closest teachings of all. So that the inner secrets of the order of Melchizedek are held by the women, which you can call the feminine force within the soul. The next closest teachings are held by the apostles, the 12. And you may know that Reverend Mario said, "When I've got my 12, I'm," he used a Dutch expression, "I'm leaving," basically. And he did not mean, neither did Christ mean, by the way, 12 individuals. In fact, if you look at the list of apostles in the Bible, you will find that they are different disciples. They're different lists of 12. So does that mean that some lists are right and some lists are wrong? No, it just means that there are a lot more than 12 people, but there are 12 teams, 12 streams, if you like. Now, what happened when Jesus talked? Well, Jesus gave the deepest mysteries to the women. He then, but they didn't hear it through his speech. They got it on a mind-to-mind level. But the people who heard the words first were the apostles, the disciples. So they turned round and gave it to the next set of disciples. And who were the next set of disciples? Well, they, in the New Testament, are called the 72. And that's an occult name because in the deep teachings of the Judaic mysteries, there are 72 names of God. There are 72 flames of fire. I know you're saying, what's this got to do with the Bible or with the Mass, but I'm getting there. So that the next rank of disciples are called the 72. They're the next closest to Christ. Now, they don't have the mysteries that the 12 are given, but they have access to the teachings. And let me make a distinction. The disciples were given power. That's why Jesus sent out the 12 disciples. And why it was the 12 disciples who became the apostles later on. What did the 72 have? They had the teachings. They had the spiritual practices. There are 72 different spiritual practices in the order of Melchizedek. And in the last 10 years, Melody and I have given each and every one of the 72 practices of the order of Melchizedek. Now, I'm not going to tell you where to find these or what they are. Some things, as the writers of textbooks would say, have to be left up to the students. So if you may know immediately what the 72 are, or it may take a while. Now, outside the 72 were the 5,000. Remember there were 5,000 people there? Now, 5,000 doesn't mean there were literally 5,000 people. It means those in the outer circle. And they were the people who are still priests, but have no inclination to come closer. But they still hang around. They still live because they know that something valuable can come to them to help them in their own lives. And they are good people. They will go back and do good things because they have experienced the emanation of Christ. Now, Pauline, you want to know about the Mass. Well, the Mass is not what you think it is. It's not a set of words. It's not a set of motions. It's a power. But it's a power not of the 5,000, nor of the 72. It's a power of the 12. So the Eucharist, and again, I'm sorry to refer to the Bible, but it's very clear in the Bible. I don't know why the Bible is difficult. Who was at the Last Supper, which is where the Eucharist was created? The apostles, the disciples, the 12 disciples. That's why it's the 12 who have the mystery of the Mass. I hope you've got that. Now, the thing is, to all of those who have an opinion about the Mass, first of all, why don't you just throw the opinion away? Who cares what the opinion is? Why don't you ask yourself, to what have I been called? Have I been called to the 12? You will know this because you will be attracted to the Mass. I'm sorry to say that. That's the fact of the matter. You only discover the reality of the Mass if you have been called to be part of the 12. It's elitist, yes. Spirit is elitist. It's hierarchical. Someone just used the word hierarchy in their question. I remember it. I'm not that far out of human consciousness. So you have to be called to do the Mass. I'm going to say that once more. You don't want to do the Mass. You don't do the Mass because you're religious. You don't do it as a spiritual practice. You do it because you have to. You're called to it. And then you're called because you're one of the 12. It doesn't matter if you're not one of the 12. That doesn't matter. You can be a good priest regardless. What you won't have is power. And that's all I'm going to say about the Mass. You don't have to do the Mass. In fact, most of our priests probably don't do the Mass. In fact, I don't know if you've noticed, but when we ordain people now, the ordinand doesn't even get to do the Mass. And we have followed spirit because the expression of the Mass is retreating. In fact, I think the new reading has already indicated that the mysteries are retreating. Now, we know that Reverend Mario incarnated in order to manifest the order of Melchizedek. Now, for goodness sake, what does that mean? It doesn't just mean that he came in to tap a few people on the head and say, "You are a priest, off you go, be fruitful and multiply in the priesthood." No, what it means is that he came to, for the first time in 1,000 years, unfold and manifest in the world the mysteries of the order. And the mystery that he particularly manifested in the world was known as the cosmic mass. And of course, the mystery can only be manifest in an outward form. But is our outward form who we are inside? I would hate to think that I am judged by this physical body. I would rather be judged by the love that I bring into the world, by the care that I give people, by the thoughtfulness. Hopefully I do some of these things in my life. I would rather be judged by this, if someone's going to judge me, than by the physical appearance. Well, that's what you're doing when you judge the Mass and say, it's just a set of gestures and words. Forget it. You are looking at the outward expression. Now, here's a secret. It's a positive feedback cycle. You know, the purpose of the Mass, doing the Mass, is to open spiritual vision. Because if your spiritual vision was open and you saw what happened in the spiritual worlds when Mass was done by an ordained priest of the Order of Melchizedek, you would fall on your face and weep, because not one of us deserves the glory of what happens. And I don't want to say too much more about it, because the thing is that if you do the Mass, if you've been called to do the Mass, your spiritual eyes will open, but then your spiritual eye has to be opened anyway, to some extent, in order to hear the call. So it's not a simple thing. But okay, we've got the 12. Their job is to do the Mass. And this Mass, as I've said, the mystery is withdrawing. Less and less public Masses are being performed. I just want you to think about that for a second. It's not just because the Church is gone, but the Church is gone so that the Mass, the mystery, can be withdrawn from public view. That things are around backwards in spirit, so I hope you can get that. And the mystery is withdrawn because it's being misinterpreted. It had got to the stage where it was misinterpreted, and it had served its purpose. So that, yes, the Mass will disappear, except from those few who've been called and initiated into that mystery. Okay, you don't have to do Mass. In fact, don't do it. If you have an aversion to it, leave it alone. But you may not be part of the 12, but you are part of the 72. How do we know who's part of the 72? Well, I'll tell you one thing. They're argumentative. They'll do rants on you. They will tell you black is white, and a bit later, oh, no, I'm sorry, I got that wrong, white is black. They are, in fact, the incarnation of... I better not say that. There were a lot of Pharisees present in the 72, and I'm talking about in Jesus' day. And Pharisee was a good thing. Don't get me wrong, they were the teachers, the instructors, the psychotherapists, if you like, of the day. They knew the rules. They knew what souls should be doing. They were the trainers of souls. And nothing wrong with the Pharisees, it's just that they need to be shouted at from time to time, because otherwise they just get caught up in being a Pharisee. Paul was a Pharisee, you remember, and he was the most free of all of them, but he was still proud of being a Pharisee. So the 72 contain the teachings, but not the mystical experience and the clairvoyant perception. No, they contain the intellectual teachings, the metaphysics, the occultism, the theology. And they will be great readers very often. They'll often read lots of books. Or they'll be people who go from one spiritual group to another. There's nothing wrong with that. But they will have a power too, because Pharisees were very devotional people. And that is why the 72 words of God have been given, because it has been spirit knew that the mysteries were withdrawing. And so Spirit allowed us in the last 10, 20 years to give the 72 spiritual practices. And Pauline, you've asked about this, but I'm not going to give you that answer, because that would just promote intellectual laziness. And I know that you are not an intellectually lazy person. So I'm going to set you this little task. For this year, you do nothing else, find out the secret of the 72, what they are, and pick just one. That would be good. Now, outside the 72, there are, of course, the 5,000. And these people don't do any spiritual practice whatsoever, but they are still priests. And what do you think happened when the 5,000 left being with Jesus? They went back home, but they were changed people. And their change helped other people to change. So that in the outer part of the priesthood, the outer petals of the rose, if you consider the whole of Jesus sitting in the middle of the disciples and teaching as this Christ in the middle of the rose, then the outer petals of the rose, they are the priesthood. I was going to use not a very nice word there, but I want to say priesthood by infection or priesthood by contagion, but that has very bad... It means... I know what it is. It's the Midas touch priesthood. If you remember, King Midas turned everything to gold when he touched it. And if you're a priest in this sense, you don't have to say anything. Just touch people. Just sit with them. Just don't analyse them. Don't make judgments about them. What do they care about your judgments? But just be with people. Just remember from time to time that you are a priest. Just think about it. Don't think what it means. Once we get tied up into what it means and what I should be doing and what actions I should be taking, we lose it. Just, I'm a priest. I'm a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek. And as the century flows on, the mysteries of the order will retreat more and more. Fewer and fewer souls will be called to the 12 to have the power that flows through you when you do the Mass. But there are deeper mysteries than the 12. Didn't I mention the women? At the core of the order of Melchizedek is, first of all, the mystery of three. And the three are the three special disciples. You know that Jesus, sorry, it's the Bible again. Jesus, when he wanted to be with us alone and do something particularly powerful, selected three disciples. James, John and Peter. Always the same lot. So what did Jesus tell them to do? What's the core secret of the order of Melchizedek? What did Jesus tell them to do? He said, watch and pray. Watch and pray. How hard is that to do? And because it's the core, it's the most difficult practice to come to. But there's a deeper mystery. And one might call this is the mystery of the two that are one. And even Reverend Mario would not reveal this mystery during his lifetime, and he teased us with it from time to time. But that's the mystery of the male and the female uniting. And that mystery is available in outward form, like all the other mysteries. We call it sex. But in the inward spiritual experience, it happens within self. Don't need a partner to have that inner unity. But when one comes to the core of the Christ, then we find that where there were two, me and you, there is now only one. And that's the finality of the mystery of the order of Melchizedek. And we come to that point, then we too shall be Christ's. Do you know, in ancient times, the teacher who'd been realized, the priest who'd reached that point of inner unity, was also called a Christ. Because, like Christ, it simply means anointed, we too have been anointed. Well, I think that's a comprehensive discussion of the Mass. Mm. Even though we just started.
I hope you're not going to go on all night. Kidding. Okay, I have a question here from Ken. He says, been thinking about the conflict in Israel. No need to say how terribly sad this really is. Quite some time ago, Mario delivered a talk in Hawthorne Road where he made a statement that implied souls who continually incarnate into the same place long enough where revenge and retribution continually play out with no resolve, then the powers in the spiritual realms will take the life force, essence, consciousness of these souls and use that essence somewhere else. I am not suggesting that this conflict is at that stage, if indeed it is possible that such a thing can happen. I think my question is, will the conflict that we are witnessing be resolvable within the spiritual realms, spheres of influence? I hope this question makes sense. When does karma cease to be a factor, to be a way to end an eye for an eye?
Well, this will be a brief answer, Ken. Spiritual ethics, if you like, prevent me from making statements about the realities that lie behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. They are far too long. They would take another 10 years to explain. But I think that to go to the core of your question, can a soul die? That's really what you're asking. Yes, a soul can die. And in ancient times, this was said, he who rejects the Creator God and who slanders the bodies, his soul will die. That's a very enigmatic saying, but I'll say it again. He who rejects the Creator God and who slanders the body, his soul will die. And just to say it very briefly, that when the ego, the astral mind, becomes so empowered by certain spiritual forces that it actually rejects God, rejects its divinity, then we're dealing with a dead soul. Oh, it slanders the body, doesn't mean a physical body necessarily, although you would be seeing this in Gaza, wouldn't you? There's a lot of slandering the physical body going on. No, it means all the bodies, astral body, etheric body, soul body. In other words, saying these things don't exist. I don't have to worry about it. There's only here and now. Now, do you know, this is germane to the war, that the greatest instrument which denies the Creator God and slanders the body is certain expressions of organized religion. Now, I can't do any more than give you a few hints here. Karma has nothing to do with it. Karma becomes automatic after a while. But why have karma? Why would a dead soul have karma? Once a soul's died, it has no more karma. Karma is to renew and rejuvenate. But if you look carefully at the sources of conflict between Israel and Palestine, you would discover that on both sides, they are founded in an incredible hypocrisy on the behalf of certain representatives of both religions. In other words, people who justify their actions of murder on both sides through the dogma of a formalized religion. I think that's all I can say. Those people, if the soul hasn't died already, it's on its way. And although Christ makes no more use of a dead soul, because after all, Christ is about life, and these souls have rejected life, nevertheless, there are certain other spiritual forces that happily accept the gift of that soul, and as you say, absorb the soul forces that were there. That is the end for this cycle of incarnations. Not necessarily that such souls will have to come back as human beings in the next cycle of incarnations, which we know as Jupiter. And there, whereas we'll be of the end, hopefully humanity will have moved on to the angelic status, these people come back and be given another chance as human beings. They will have the slate wiped clean and they will be able to start again. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we have a delightful question from Judith, where she asks, what place does gratitude have in our spiritual life? And how does gratitude work generally and particularly in healing? Thank you.
Thank you, Judith, for that most beautiful and insightful question. One could say that gratitude is the inescapable response of a spiritual being to the experience of the higher spiritual reality. Now, gratitude and music, gratitude and singing especially, are hugely connected. It's almost impossible feel grateful and not want to sing about it. And very often our singing is an expression of our gratitude. At the core of the centre of the order of Melchizedek is the experience of Christ. And it may be that we see him in a physical or a form, a body of some description, as the people did on the road to Emmaus. But it may be that our experience of Christ is like having the lid lifted off the top of our head, and everything opens up, and suddenly we are aware that we are not alone. Human consciousness is the only consciousness that is alone. It's cut off from the spiritual worlds. When we have the experience that we are not alone, that we are in fact linked, and there's no English word to describe how we are connected to the hierarchy and to the fabric of the spiritual world. It's as though we are knitted in to the tapestry, the multicoloured tapestry composed of billions and billions of threads, that is the tapestry of creation. We are part of that. Our little threads, they are threading through there somewhere. Sometimes they complete a picture, sometimes they start a picture. And the creation of the tapestry is the creation of beauty. And like little Mario in his story, one day we may be able to stand up and see the tapestry, the whole picture from above. And when we do that, we experience the power of beauty in the world, which is, as Plato would say, the power of the good in the world, which, as Plato would say, also is the power of God, or the power of one. And Plato would say also that what lifts us towards the beautiful, the one, the good, the Christ, what lifts us first of all is the wings of love. And once the wings of love open and we start to fly a little bit, then we are filled with the gratitude of the child that discovers the love of the parent. And then there is healing, there's spiritual healing. We're healed on a soul level. Once you've had that experience, then your karma is indeed forgiven. Which doesn't mean that you don't have to come back in and repay that person the money that you swindled them in the 11th century, or have to come back in and scrub a few stairs because you were nasty to the housemaid in Victorian England. It doesn't mean that you don't have to do all those things. But when you do, you come back and do it with joy. And I can't think of a more beautiful way to conclude the meeting with the hierarchy by accepting the embrace, the love, and the joy that flows from the spiritual worlds, the brotherhoods, the hierarchy, the angels, the archangels, the thrones, dominions, the archimites, the powers, the cherubim and seraphim, into the humility of the stable, which is where Christ is born within the human heart. So shall it be.
Now I can only think of one thing to do right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, love that knoweth of no fear. Oh, love that sheds a joyous tear. Oh, love that makes me whole and free. Such love shall keep and hallow me. Oh, love that knoweth of no fear. Oh, love that sheds a joyous tear. Oh, love that makes me whole and free. Such love shall keep and
and gratitude to you. Thank you. Deserves to be gratified.